The case originally scheduled as the second case today, United Steelworkers against Cooper Standard Hose, has been dismissed pursuant to Rule 42. We'll move to the third case of the day, therefore, number 033813, David Burgetzi against William Horton. Mr. Ray.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is John Ray, and I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, David Burgetzi. Although there are a number of issues that were raised in the briefs, I believe there are two critical issues on which this court can decide this case, and indeed to reverse the decision of the district court, and on which it should focus its attention. The first of those issues is exhaustion under Section 1997E, as amended by the Prison Litigation Reform Act. The second is preclusion under the Supreme Court's decision in Heck versus Humphrey and under the Illinois common law doctrine of collateral estoppel. I'd like to first start with the issue of exhaustion under Section 1997E. And as it relates to that issue, even were this court to accept Defendant Horton's version of the facts, it's clear on the basis of this court's decisions that Burgetzi satisfied his exhaustion obligation. There are two critical facts relevant to this issue, which Defendant Horton has alleged himself and does not dispute. The first is that Burgetzi filed a grievance with the Cook County Department of Corrections on November 27, 2000. The second is that the Cook County Department of Corrections never responded to that November 27th grievance. Indeed, to this day, some 4 years and several days later, the Cook County Department of Corrections has said nothing and did nothing to respond to that grievance. The county did not respond within the 30 days it was required to do so. Moreover, what the county did do, and its officers did do, was actively participate in a criminal prosecution of Mr. Burgetzi for his conduct in this
In the incident.
Could I ask you, Mr. Ray, what weight, if any, should this court give to the original verified complaints that Mr. Burgetzi started this case out with, in which he does make allegations, as I recall, the earlier filings?
Well, that depends, I think, to some extent on which issue is being addressed concerning the district court's application, the district court's decision in this case. The district court did deem admissions in this case, and particularly Defendant Horton's allegations. And I would say, in the circumstance were this court to accept the district court's application of Local Rule 56-1, then I think the cases of this court are clear that admissions trump evidence. And so we feel that still, even accepting those allegations, this court can simply decide that Burgetzi did, in fact, exhaust his administrative remedies under Section 1997E.
Right. Now, could I ask whether your principal point is that the record as it now exists before us affirmatively shows exhaustion, or whether your point is that the record as it now is before us creates a genuine issue of material fact about exhaustion?
No, our position is that the record, what you said first, affirmatively shows that he did in fact exhaust.
So even though this November grievance is late according to the regulations that govern the facility, the fact that the defendants never did anything with it, never allowed him to come forward and show that he actually had filed the August grievance, et cetera, is enough, in your view, to show exhaustion?
Yes, and there are two points on that. The first is, to the extent, one, I'm not so sure that the detainee grievance procedure under Cook County, the Cook County Department of Corrections, determines that this is late and cannot be heard. That there is no regulation in the procedure that says a grievance that is late cannot be heard. And in fact, I point this court's attention to page 150 of our appendix, where 151 of our appendix, where it talks about the filing of detainee grievances, and it states in particular that a detainee may file a grievance at any time that affects those areas outlined in Article 2, Section E1A, and A relates to allegations of violations of civil, constitutional, and statutory rights. So on the first point, I think it's not very clear that this is a procedurally defaulted complaint, a grievance, simply because it was untimely.
But under our decision in POZO, we say you have to follow the rules that are established by the institution, and it was my understanding that under the detainee grievance procedure, that filing needs to take place within 15 days of the allegedly grievable event.
I don't disagree that that is the general rule, but I believe that the grievance procedure also states specifically that as to allegations of civil constitutional or violation of civil constitutional statutory rights, those grievances may be filed at any time. And that's the language of the procedure at 151 of our appendix.
Is that for an ongoing violation or one that has a definitive time?
I see the difference you're making, and I'm not sure that the grievance procedure makes that distinction, whether it's ongoing or whether it's isolated. So it's not clear, and I think that leads then to the second point, and that is that under the cases of this court, in particular, we cited Ford versus Johnson and Esther versus Principe relating to procedural defaults, and that is that when an agency fails to assert a procedural default, that this court does not apply that default here later in a federal action. That's important because, as Esther points out, a number of principles. One, that under Chenery, the Supreme Court's decision in Chenery, an agency has an obligation to state and stand on the reasons its reasons for its administrative action here. That's important here because we don't know. It's not clear necessarily on the grievance procedure whether an untimely complaint cannot be heard, whether that untimeliness can be waived or remedied in some particular circumstance, and that even there is a procedural default that bars the county from responding to an untimely grievance. Having not stated that, having not responded to that grievance, this court does not apply state procedural defaults when the state agency itself did not apply it, and that did not happen in this case. And that would be the second point as to default.
Could I ask you about this dribbling out of the deposition that's been going on, you know, a few pages attached to the state's motion and then more pages getting attached to the response, and then you have a footnote in your brief on page 29, footnote 3, indicating these kind of missing pages would have shown that it was very clear. You've made the argument, as I understand it, that although the local rules allow the moving party to the moving party's facts to be accepted if the other side doesn't file a response, on the other hand, it still also needs to be reasonably supported, as I understand you.
That's correct.
And that in the absence of the full context, it wasn't. They couldn't just come in with a reply brief and say, oh, here are a few more pages.
I would say it's even more than that, actually, that even if you simply look to the deposition transcript that was cited, it does not, if it's being viewed in the light most favorable to Brangetzi, as it should have been on defendant's motion for summary judgment, it does not state they were talking about what Mr. Brangetzi did to appeal the Cook County Department's corrections failure to respond to his grievance, his initial grievance, which he declared, indeed the record is peppered with his declarations, that he filed an initial grievance on August 23rd, 2000.
Yeah.
Yes. So it's clear that even looking at that, they were talking about, well, what did you do in response to their failure to respond to you? And
well,
he says,
that's at page 28. You're telling me you never appealed. Is that what your testimony is? And then it goes on to say the only form you filed, according to your testimony, is this grievance form. But you're saying we should read that in the light most favorable to him as
yes.
He filed the grievance form, but he didn't file an appeal because he never heard from them.
No, I'm saying if the way that I would read that is that the first question asks, did you or did you not file an appeal? No. And the next question asks, you do not, which can only be understood in the context of the prior question, you did not file an appeal. No. And then the next question, I believe, still continues from that line of questioning about an appeal, and it says, the only form you filed that can be construed as an appeal, really, is our interpretation, is this grievance form that you identified here today. What did you do in response to the Cook County Department's failure to respond to you? I filed another grievance. There was an issue, at least as it was identified in the defendant's initial motion to dismiss. Brangetzi, what he had done was he had attached to his response to their motion to dismiss some four grievances dated November 27th, I believe November 30th, December 5th, and some other ones. And it's clear that his answer is, of those grievances, the only one I filed, the only thing that I put in to respond to their failure was this initial grievance form. He knew he couldn't appeal because he needed a decision from the Cook County Department of Corrections. So what he did, the only thing he could do, was file another grievance. And that's what I believe is the reasonable interpretation of that passage just on its own. But then when we consider the declarations that were made by Brangetzi in his original verified complaint and his first amended verified complaint, and also in his complaint to the Illinois Department of Corrections, which was attached to his response to the defendant's motion for summary judgment, it's clear that he's alleged repeatedly, I filed a grievance on August 23rd, 2000. They never responded to it. What did I do? I tried to get help. No one would help me. What did I do? I filed another grievance, and they've never responded. And that's the point. So I would say yes, under this court's decision in Stewart versus McGinnis, it's clear that the defendants did not adequately and properly support their statement of material fact that the one and only grievance that Mr. Brangetzi filed was on November 27th. And that's another basis for this court to reverse the decision of the district court on the issue of exhaustion. There's one quick point that I'd like to make on exhaustion before I sit down, as I see I'm eating into my rebuttal time, and that is that even if this court were to find that Brangetzi did not properly exhaust, the district court improperly dismissed on the grounds of exhaustion with prejudice. And that dismissal, of course, under this court's decision should have been without prejudice. Indeed, there was also a state law claim that Brangetzi brought for willful and wanton misconduct that should not have been dismissed under Section 1997E because that is not applicable. It was a state law claim that should have been dismissed also without prejudice and for lack of supplemental jurisdiction under this court's cases. And I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ray. We'll hear now from Mr. Allegretti.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Allegretti. I'm an assistant state's attorney, and I represent the appellee in this case. To clarify the facts briefly, on August 21st of the year 2000, Mr. Brangetzi was a detainee at the Cook County Department of Corrections. On that date, pursuant to a directive of a Cook County correctional officer, he and other detainees were ordered from the first floor to return to the second floor dormitories. The detainees, except for Mr. Brangetzi, they followed that directive. Mr. Brangetzi went to an unauthorized portion of the jail without permission. When he decided to return to the second floor dormitory where he was required to go initially, he confronted and assaulted and battered Officer Horton.
Well, Mr. Allegretti, wait a minute here, because I think taking the facts in the light most favorable to Mr. Brangetzi, we get to the point where he's handcuffed. And at that point, he alleged, and that is relevant to, you know, the criminal prosecution and so on and so forth. Fine. But he's handcuffed. At that point, he alleges, and we have to take the facts in the light most favorable to him at this point, that he is hurled down a couple of flights of stairs and his teeth are chipped and so forth. And you seem to be making the rather extraordinary argument that once somebody is handcuffed, there's no limit to the force that correctional officers can apply to him. I suppose they could have ripped his fingernails off, too, and that would have been fine because he had committed the offense of assaulting the officer. That's not the law.
Can I respond?
Please.
Your Honor, I don't believe at all that is what we're suggesting. In fact, I will tell you we are not suggesting that. What we are suggesting is a concern that was raised by you, Judge Wood. The concern was, what weight do we give pleadings? If this was at the pleading stage, I would agree with you, because according to the pleadings, there were three pleadings. The first two were pro se. However, the third pleading, which is the one we are here on, was filed by Cochran, Cherry, and Givens in Montgomery, a very competent law firm. We are in no way suggesting that. What we are asserting is the rules and the facts are those not in the briefs, because, no, I'm sorry, not in the complaints. In fact, this court has held in the case of Kellis versus Colgate-Palmolive in 2000 and numerous other cases, that when you have deposition testimony that is part of the record, we will not go back and look at other documents such as pleadings or affidavits that contradict. And instead, we must look to the evidence or the record. And the record is, under 56.1, the local rules, what is the evidence before the court? That's not the evidence before the court, and that's not what the district court had the benefit of reviewing, Your Honor.
The state never denied that he wound up in the hospital, as I recall. Right?
Well, the state did this. The state did comply with Rule 56.1 and did not, because that was not a material fact. We presented the material.
Well, you didn't address one way or the other this fact.
Well,
you didn't address anything that happened after the arrest.
Your Honor, we were...
Why is there any fact at all before the court after the arrest, after the handcuffing?
That's a very good question, and one that Local Rule 56.1 directly addresses. What the courts have to do is look to the evidence and the facts that are before it. And, in fact, these facts that you're concerned about weren't before the court because they weren't part of the record. There was deposition testimony that, if that was a concern, Your Honor, and it very well may have been, that the appellant had the opportunity under Rule 56.1 to raise that concern. The appellant chose not to. The appellant chose to, instead of responding pursuant to 56.1 by either contradicting the facts that we presented, the material facts that we believed as advocates were material. Appellant could very well have disagreed, like this court has a concern, but it was up to the appellant at that time at the district court to follow the local rules. This court, nor is the district court, required under Smith versus Lamb, a 2002 case, to go through all these issues and all these documents. This is a very legitimate concern the court has. But you know what? The reason we have Local Rule 56.1 is so that you don't have to ask this question, Your Honor. It's so that the district court doesn't have to ask this question. You know why? Because the question you are asking is better for me and better for the appellant's attorney.
Oh, okay. I mean, I understand how the rules work, I assure you. We deal with them every day. But the fact is, this case was very badly handled by the state. No responses were ever given to grievances that this man filed. This would have been much easier if you had done your job a little sooner, too.
Well,
because no one can, in fact, problems can't even be solved up front if the correctional facilities don't respond to grievances. The whole point of the grievance procedure is to resolve disputes before they get into the district court, even. It's to make sure that correctional officers, if they're behaving entirely in accordance with the law, that the inmate gets the message. It's also, if they aren't, that corrective measures can be taken. And when people file grievances and they go off into Never Never Land, as perhaps the November grievance went, certainly there's nothing in the excerpt that you've given of the plaintiff's deposition about the November 27th grievance that makes any... that gives any indication that there was ever a decision, that there was ever anything that came from that, and apparently it's not in the record.
Your Honor, I would disagree. There is something in the record, and that is at 53, Exhibit D, and that is the, I believe it's Exhibit D, and that is the opinion, the...
this is the person who searched the records, I bet you're going to tell me, but...
This is the person that searched
right.
the record.
And all I'm saying is we have competent evidence from this man. People are entitled to testify about what they experienced personally. You would agree with that?
I would agree with that.
All right. And he says he never got a response. So she says he did. He says he didn't.
Your Honor, in
that... You agree that the November 27th grievance was filed, and that's what I'm talking about.
Well, I'm suggesting that it was completed, and the district court found that it was filed.
Right.
Correct.
And so it was, everybody agrees, and that's what I'm talking about, but never did he get a response.
There's nothing in the record to suggest that.
Yes, there is. His testimony says, I never got a response. That's competent testimony.
Well, first of all, with regard to that, if you're looking at the pleadings, which are not part of...
I'm not looking at the pleadings. I'm looking at what he attached to his response,
which
may have not been technically quite a 56.1 response, but it's there before the district court at the relevant time. And the point is, there's nothing here that says it happened. Exhaustion is a defense, right?
Well, exhaustion is a requirement that must be met pursuant to Perez and pursuant to Porter versus Nussel. And what's important, Your Honor...
Right, an answer. I didn't even hear from the committee board. Question. So if the records reflect you received a response, we've got a document showing, did you file an appeal? But there's no... Is that what your testimony is? I mean, that's the most interrupted and ambiguous exchange I can imagine.
Well, Your Honor, I will tell you, it is an interrupted and ambiguous exchange.
Don't
and I will
nothing.
Ask that...
Well, it doesn't prove...
Well, first of all, it is very much proof on that point, but I will suggest that this
what
was
point?
A very on the point that only one grievance was filed. We acknowledge that. We don't disagree with the fact that a grievance was filed approximately 4 months after the incident.
It's not
However,
evidence that there was only one grievance filed. It's evidence that there was a grievance filed on November 27th.
There was a grievance filed. Now, you have to realize the evidence also suggests that Mr. Brangetti was a multiple...
So what? I mean, everybody... Look, half these people are, you know, but November 27th, it's absolutely evidence that there was a November 27th grievance, but it is not evidence that that was the one and only one grievance.
The evidence that we submitted is that there was a grievance filed and that no appeal was filed. But the only grievance we have was that of November 27th of 2000. Now, it's ambiguous, and I would agree, if this is a point, and this is exactly why Rule 56.1 is here, these concerns that you have should have been addressed at the district court. The district court, under Walridge versus Host, which was argued before Judge Ripple, these rules aren't a mere formality. They are a must, and if you
Look,
don't
this
comply,
court sits as a court. I mean, we all attempt to respect what every member of the court has written.
Yep, what I'm saying is in that court, in numerous cases out of the Seventh Circuit here, that it is not a mere harmless technicality, but rather a fatal flaw.
Nobody thinks it is a harmless technicality. What we're trying to figure out is what did you hold up your end of the bargain in 56.1? Did Mr. Brangetti hold up his end of the bargain? You've been crystal clear that you don't think he did.
Well, and we are crystal
Question
clear.
Question is, did you?
Absolutely, Your Honor. We filed pursuant to 56.1. We supported our record. We supported our facts by the record. We supported the fact that even if you assume,
excerpts.
Even assuming arguendo, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's all right.
Even assuming arguendo that he did not get a response. The key is, under the grievance procedures, it is required, it is mandated that they be followed. The courts have consistently held that substantial compliance, and this court held that substantial compliance is not acceptable. Rather,
a grievance with no response, this court has also said, is all the person has to do. You don't have to file an appeal from something you never got a response to.
I believe the courts have consistently held here in the Seventh Circuit that a timely grievance that complies with the general rules that are in effect at the Cook County Jail, there must be a response.
If the response, though, has to come from you, and we have also held in our decisions that if the state doesn't give the person a response, the person has done all that he can do.
Your Honor, if I could, in this case, there's no evidence pursuant to the rules that actually occurred. It's a concern, and one of the reasons we have the Rule 56.1 is to streamline this process so this doesn't have to occur. In addition, independent of that, Your Honor, under Heck versus Humphrey, when you have an underlying conviction that could ultimately be undermined or
this
the implication...
This would not be in the slightest bit, as Judge Bucklow found, undermined.
Well,
this case.
I would suggest that Judge Bucklow was deciding on the pleadings as it was a 12b-6, and there was no discovery and there were no facts. In addition, the collateral estoppel, the issue of issue preclusion, also bars. In this case, the trial court found that there was no excessive force in this case, in this incident.
Not about after the arrest, though. They're talking about whether this guy assaulted the officer in an inappropriate way, and he obviously did. There's a criminal finding. He shouldn't have done it. He took a swing at the officer. That doesn't mean that from that point onward, he's subject to torture in the jail.
Well, I would suggest that there's nothing in the evidence or the record that would suggest that.
But you don't want to hold that as a matter of law. You don't want to say, well, all bets are off once you've legitimately been arrested. That's not the law.
I would agree 100%. And what we're saying the law is that a timely grievance must be filed. Perez, this court is has verified that.
Well, you're changing the subject. I mean, you were on collateral estoppel in Heck versus Humphrey. If you want to go back to exhaustion, we can go back to exhaustion.
Well, I am saying these two issues are also independent bases. And finally, Your Honor, all claims are allowed to be dismissed with prejudice. The court has routinely dismissed all claims.
Not in exhaustion issues.
With regard to exhaustion, the only time it has not is in the case of Ford versus Johnson, which was cited by the appellant. That case was the shortcoming there was not that there was an untimely grievance. The grievance was filed timely in Johnson. The difference was he jumped the gun and went before the court before it was time and ripe. So by dismissing the case without prejudice, the plaintiff could go back. Unless we have a time machine, this appellant cannot go back. He filed 4 months
afterwards. The point is that's for the state courts. That's for the state courts. If the state courts want to apply that rule, let them apply that rule. It's really none of our business. It's a matter of state law.
But the district is a matter of law at the district court. The district court was bound by the rules that were before it.
And it doesn't have anything to do with whether a dismissal is without prejudice. There could be tolling rules in the state court. There could be other rules. State claims are maybe not subject. Indeed, they're not subject to 1997. It's really, this court has said exhaustion problems yield dismissals without prejudice.
Well, we would just finally like to address the issue of review, and we assert that it is not in this particular case, with regard to the evidentiary portion and as to what evidence was submitted, it is not de novo, rather is abuse of discretion. We don't dispute that on summary judgments, the review is de novo. But what Judge St. Eves did in making her evidentiary rulings as to what was before it and what was in the record, that was to be reviewed de novo. It is not fair to question Judge St. Eves' handling of this case or undermine that handling when she complied the local rules. And this court, if I could just finish my thought, this court has consistently said that the local rules can be applied stringently or leniently, and that is exactly what Judge St. Eves did. We would respectfully request that Judge St. Eves' decision of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Allegretti.
Thank you.
Mr. Ray, you have 3 minutes.
Unless this court has any questions, I'm willing to surrender the remainder of my time.
Well, evidently not, Mr. Ray. Our thanks to both counsel in the case. Mr. Ray, you took this case by appointment of the court, and you have the deep thanks of the court, as does your law firm, for the amount of time that you put into this case and for the excellence of the submission that you've given us. We very much appreciate it. So with our thanks to both counsel, the case will be taken under advisement.